Welcome to Elaine's. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. It's good to have you at Elaine's Literary Salon. We've turned this into a literary hub for the Washington, D.C. area. You are, and I'm probably getting this wrong, but I think you're our 184th author that I've interviewed. We've been doing at least one a week.
Wow.
Thank you. If you go to elainesliterarysalon.com, you can see our upcoming schedule. It's usually at least one a week. Our podcast now is number one on Spotify. We're number three on Apple for literary things. So come and check us out. So this is exciting. This is Bill's is our second time interviewing together. That puts you in elite company.
Oh, good. That's right where I belong.
So Bill Rapp began his professional career as an academic teaching European history at Iowa State University. He received his BA from Notre Dame, his master's from the University of Toronto, and a PhD from Vanderbilt. Bill has always been intrigued by German history, but the last 35 years working for the U.S. government has broadened his perspective to all of Europe and much of the Middle East. His career has taken him around the world, including to Berlin, as the wall fell and Germany was reunified. Bill Rapp's books include mystery novels Angel in Black, A Pale Rain, Burning Altars, Berlin Breakdown, Tears of Innocence, The Habsburg Variation, and then we talked about Assignment in Saigon last time, and today we're here to talk about his latest, The Prague Spring. Bill Rapp is proudly a member of the Mystery Writers of America, International Thriller Writers, and the International Association of Crime Writers. So please welcome Bill Rapp. Bill, it's fun to have you back here again. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. It's fun to be back here. I'm really looking forward to this evening. The last session for Assignment in Saigon was also a lot of fun and very informative and very helpful. So thank you.
You're very welcome. It's good to have you. Why don't we tell us a little bit about the Prague Spring? No spoilers.
Okay. Oh, that's going to be tough. Well, I mean, you all know how it turned out.
Yeah.
If not, then you should definitely read the book. Anyway, the Prague Spring is I sort of saw this as sort of the ultimate adventure for Karl Barr and his progress working for the CIA through the Cold War, because it was one of the most impactful and dramatic events of the Cold War. I mean, he was involved in others as well, the Soviet invasion of Budapest and Hungary, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But he, in the Prague Spring, I mean, at the time, it seemed so hopeful, the Dubček reforms to create socialism with a human face, and as they called it. And the great question everybody's mind was, of course, was what's the Kremlin going to allow? What are they going to allow to go on? How's it going to? And at times, people had hope and were pretty optimistic. But as we found out later on, of course, the Kremlin had been planning all along to bring this experiment and reform to an abrupt end because they feared the contagious effect it would have throughout Eastern Europe, where they had often had numerous problems in the past. So for somebody in Karl Barr's position, the question that he has to respond to, or the question Washington's asking him, is like, well, how is this going to continue? Is it going to continue? You know, what are the prospects for this? What can we expect from this? What's the impact it's going to have? And what's Moscow going to do? And that's what he's trying to figure out throughout. And he develops a network of contacts in and out of the government to help him with that. And it all comes to an abrupt end one August morning when the Red Army rolls in. And so then suddenly his focus shifts. So what do I do about my assets, my people, that I have to protect my family to get them out of here and get them safe? And the nice thing was it was recent enough, so I was able to intersperse it with some real-life events, like Shirley Temple Black showed up just as the invasion was going on. She had been there. She had a job, an international humanitarian organization of some sort, and she showed up to see what was going on and what the benefits would be for the job she had. And, of course, she gets there. Next thing you know, she's hiding in the embassy with all the other Americans that are there, and Karl Barr's job is to make sure that his people are safe that work for him, but also the assets, and how do you get out? And that requires all sorts of new adventures, new practices, new alliances, some of which are rather suspicious with good reason. And it's how does he navigate that, and how does he get him, his people, and himself out of there? And what's the follow on to that, which is the final scene, little Franciscan church in Vienna, which was very near the hotel I stayed at on the Ringstrasse when I was doing some training for the liaison services over there. So I think that's sort of the book in a nutshell. And I think it encapsulates so much of, you know, the challenges for the agency, for America, and for Europe and the free world at the time, both on a personal and a professional and strategic level. which I hope the book pulls together for people, for readers.
Well, it's really authentic. When I hear you talk about it, I hear you talking about the historical elements of it as much as the plot of the book, right? And I know it's like on Amazon, it's historical fiction. It's also like military fiction. They have you in a bunch of categories. To me, this reads just like espionage. So, do you have a specific genre that you believe this belongs in?
I would agree with you. I think it's really espionage fiction. I mean, and historical fiction, because it is all the books in the Cold War series have real life historical settings, you know, as the backdrop in which Karl Barth finds himself in the middle of. Of course, the characters are fictional. The personal and specific events are fictional, but it's all against a backdrop of real history. So yeah, what I would say historical fiction, but it's really the story about how an intelligence officer faces these challenges and to provide the service he's supposed to provide, you know, to help inform U.S. policymakers so that they can create better policies and better informed and more beneficial policies for the United States. So I think I would say historical espionage fiction first, historical fiction second. And that's, I think, I try and reflect that and very much in how Karl Barth goes about his job and he works, you know, because he's an officer and at times he's in a management position. And what people don't seem to realize is that requires a whole other set of responsibilities, you know, and I try and bring that out as well. But you can't focus on it too much because you're going to lose your reader's interest because they're looking for something exotic and action-filled, you know. So you have to respond to that as well. But you want to make it plausible and realistic. At least I do. And that's one of the things I aim for in these books.
So that's a really important point, right? That you're trying to meet your reader expectations, trying to give them what they're looking for. So to what extent, because this is also listed as thriller, what is it that you're looking at for like pacing? And do you consider this a thriller? And like how deep can you go into the politics or history you just talked about before you're slowing down the pace too much?
That's a good question. And it's a temptation for me as a historian by training is to focus so much on the history, to overdo it. So you have to work on the pacing. And I think, fortunately, there are enough events and developments in there that force the pace to move forward. So you can't just get bogged down. At one point, you'll find Karl Barth, as chief of station, he's talking to a couple of officers. And he's saying, you know, well, we got to think about this and this. You know, you might have to send you home. You know, and you stepped out when you weren't supposed to. You know, you can't be, you're not a free agent out here. But you don't want to spend too much time on that. You know, you get through that as quickly as possible and you spend more time on his response in the morning when he sees the Soviet tanks rolling down in front of his house, you know, or when he gets into the embassy to find out what's going on and you know, who's been reported in, who's still out there, what do I do about my wife and these other people I've got to get out. That's where you try and really grab your readers and bring them in, but make sure they keep in mind that there's a lot of other stuff going on in the world and in their choices. And he's fortunately, there's enough adventures that he has and things he has to overcome that keep the pace moving, I think, and in the Prague Spring.
So I've interviewed a lot of writers who are, you know, working with things in current events or they're inspired by things in the news. They're looking at current politics. You're obviously doing something historical and you've written a lot of books. So, like, what is it? And I'm avoiding the hated question by authors, like, you know, where do you get your ideas? But what was it that initiated this? Like, what was it about this period in this place? Obviously, you've been there, you spent time there. But now, when you're looking to write a book in 2026, right? Yeah, like, what is it that drives you to that?
Good question. I mean, you know, this is an event that I was just coming of age, just maturing politically, intellectually. You know, I was 16 when this happened. Sorry, getting over a virus here.
I'm just going to stand over there.
Yeah. If you have some masks to distribute amongst the crowd, might be a good idea. So it was a very eventful period for me in that time. I remember falling up my own eye, you know, reading the newspaper, what was going on. So as I was writing the earlier editions in the Cold War series, you know, there were some, I was always able to focus on, when you say where'd you get your ideas, well, in the Cold War, there was always a crisis every couple of years, you know, that Karl Barth miraculously found himself being assigned to take care of. It's great for your career progression. But he, the Prague Spring to me was sort of like the ultimate Cold War crisis. And we didn't come as close to war then as we did with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But, you know, as a fan of Europe and somebody, I was actually in Prague in the 1972 before the, you know, the old regime fell. And saw what that was like. And then, of course, we went back again when we were serving in Berlin after the wall fell. or I should say after I brought down the wall personally, and Germany reunified, we just went down to Prague for the weekend, you know, and it was like, what a different world, you know. I mean, it was just, and Charles Bridge, in my mind, is still sort of the quintessential tourist experience to walk over that bridge at night with all the people there and the statues and the river and the lights behind that lead the path that leads into the old city of in Prague. And I was able to, I should point out too, it was very fortunate that my daughter was on an R&R trip in Prague and I met her there. And of course, she's an old hockey player, so we had to go to a hockey game, which was a real true Czech experience. But it also allowed me to walk around to a lot of these old spots that that were, you know, instrumental in the revolt. And I had a picture of myself taking it, you know, besides the wall plaque in front of the Czech National Museum of Alexander Dubček, you know. And I really wanted to put that on the back cover of the book, but the publisher said, we're too far along, you know, in the print schedule, so we can't do that. But all that stuff just, I mean, that was a harbinger of 89 and the fall of the communism in Eastern Europe. So it was just such an important and significant event. I knew that this near the end of his career, Karl Bayer was going to find himself in the middle of the whole Prague Spring.
So that's, you know, obviously very incredibly important political events, significant historical events that happened. But what was it like personally for you? Because you can tell us what it's like to be in these places. Like, what was that like at that time? I think I find that fascinating.
Back to me before the fall of...
During that whole kind of the tail end of the Cold War.
The tail end of the Cold War, that was, you know, we'd had the Beijing revolt and the suppression of the popular movement in Beijing already. But we also had in Europe, we had all those East Germans that were fleeing to Prague and Budapest and the West German Ständige Vertretung, the temporary representation there, piling up, you know, and they finally, the East German regimes decided, well, we got to sort of, you know, lance this boil somehow. And so they got the trains they put in, they ran through Dresden. And when the train went through Dresden, there was a mob scene there. People were jumping on the train as it was moving through the station, doing anything to get out of the East, you know? So you knew something was happening. Something was going to happen, but not the way it did happen. And everybody, I think, knows the story about Schabowski, how he made the mistake and opened the wall up. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, Peter Schabowski had been the party leader in East Berlin, and the East Berlin East German regime was trying to sort of learn what it was like to deal with a demanding and inquisitive public. And so they were holding press conferences. But of course, these party apparatchiks, they didn't know how the hell you do a press conference, you know? And so the East German regime decided that they were going to give visas to to the East German citizens, and they could travel to the West. But it was going to be a very gradual process. They're only going to get one a year, you know, one trip allowed a year. But they didn't inform Schabowski, who was handling the press conferences. He came back late. He looks at his notes and he announces that, you know, the East German regime is going to give travel restrictions, allow East Germans to get visas to travel. And somebody, I think it was Tom Brokaw of NBC, said, when is this going to affect? Schabowski looks at his notes and he says, well, he doesn't see anything. And he says, well, I guess right away. Well, the East Germans, the East German television was not covering this, but the West German television was. And of course, most East Germans, except for those who lived around Dresden, could watch West German TV. They see this, and they flood to the wall. And that's how it happened. And then, the commanders at the base, at the various crossings said, well, they didn't have any instructions. They didn't know what to do. It could have gone south, but they said, oh, to hell with it. You know, they kept trying to call headquarters. They couldn't get a response. They said, oh, to hell with it. Left the gates. And that's how the wall opened. And then after that, there was no going back. I mean, it was, even though you didn't really weren't sure at the time, one of the things that impressed us most was, you know, when East Germans went to West Germany, you got 100 Deutschmarks of what they called Begrüßungsgeld, welcoming money. And that was, you would get that once a year. So everybody went over and they wanted to get their shopping done because they didn't know if they were going to have access to fresh fruit and stuff like that, you know. And I remember the night when it opened, I went down to the wall and you go to this little kiosk, you know, in the subway stations. These Germans, these Berliners, they were all like, what about that? I'll take that. Because they didn't know if they were going to get to come back tomorrow. So they wanted to get stuff while they could, you know, and they were buying this and this and this and this. And then so that weekend, the lines where you would go to the bank and get your money, I guess you provide your ID or something, they were lining up outside the banks, outside onto the street, around the corner, down the block. I mean, it was just amazing. It was at that point you realized they're not putting the cork back in this bottle, you know. And then I would work with the U.S. minister as a sort of a right hand guy because of my background in German history and then German fluency. He would take me to all his meetings, and we would just compare notes, and he would say, "Okay, write this up and send it back to Washington." And it was all, you could just see how things were dismantled step by step by step, and it was going to lead to, in some form, absorption by the West Germans of the East German state. It was a failed state.
So, I mean, these are crazy political times, right? Lots of human toll, lots of emotion going on. I'm curious now, once you know how something ends, it does change how you go back and look at the events at the time.
Yeah.
And also, every time you go back and remember something, right, your memory actually physically changes in your mind, right? So when you're going back now, looking at it with the lens of having seen the television show, right, and knowing the ending, how hard is it to remember, like, how hard is it to recapture that uncertainty and fear that people were experiencing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it was more of an issue in Assignment in Saigon because we all know how that war ended. We have our personal views on that. But the debate then is, for the U.S., is what are we going to do? Are we going to put boots on the ground? You know, are we going to Americanize the war in its entirety? Well, you know how that turns out. But at the time, you're trying to capture how people are thinking about it based on their experiences. And it's very difficult not to let your hindsight take over, you know? So what you try and do is create some foresight for your character using that hindsight, but don't make them perfect or omniscient. So, like for Karl Bayer, his background is experiencing communist takeovers in Eastern Europe, and that's influencing how he views Vietnam when he first goes out there. And it gradually his opinion changes as he learns various things, but you know, it's got to be a gradual learning process for him, as it was for all of us. And in terms of Prague, I think everybody was just very hopeful. This Dubček guy, that's the wonderful stuff he's doing. He's talking about free elections, which a number of people think, well, that might be a step too far. That's where the Kremlin's going to draw the line. But you didn't know where the Kremlin was going to put that line and what that was going to mean, and who all was working on the Kremlin to cut it short. I mean, it was, you know, Ulbricht in East Berlin, and I think the new communist regime in Warsaw, which had its own, you know, revolt experiences in 56. Kador in Budapest was a little more tolerant, and Tito was supportive because anything to, you know, stick it to the Kremlin. But the question was then, and since we know it is, but there's got to be that element of certainty and hope, I think, in people like Bayer and other Americans as they're looking at these events as they unfold.
So spy fiction is always really popular, and, you know, there's always intelligence operations going on. What is it about the Cold War era that draws so much interest and continues to draw so much interest many, many decades later?
I think because you're clearly delineating the line between the good guys and the bad guys, you know? I mean, we had a remarkable success in rebuilding Europe after the war and creating a prosperity, global prosperity, that was unknown in the history of man, really. And the Soviets were over there as an oppressive force with an economy that clearly didn't work. It was a mess. And I think there were just so many people in Eastern Europe that wanted it different, yearned for freedom, as we were seeing. So, excuse me, I think you do have those clear delineations, and I think, I'm not going to say anything about the contemporary situation, but I think there was just no question as to who was on the right side and who was on the wrong side, I think.
So, yeah, we generally stay away from politics, right? Because
yeah.
We're, you know,
yeah.
Readers or I have different religions and different political persuasions. However, it is an interesting question about, like, the way communism was viewed then during
mm-hmm.
the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
and now you have, you know, politicians who are openly communist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my question is not political, but about readership. With the changing views and the way, like, in this country, people look at, like, collectivism as opposed to individualism, do they read your espionage fiction in a different way? Like, if you're writing it in the environment that we had, you know, back during the Cold War, people thought about things differently than they do today. So how does that affect, like, the reading experience?
Yeah, I think you'd have to ask some of the readers, because I've not heard any feedback on that as, the, you know, gee, you're a far-left wacko, or, you know, you're just an apologist for the CIA or whatnot. And, I mean, there are distinctions between how I write about the agency and how a lot of other people write about the agency, and what I think is a negative and unrealistic light. You know, it's just everybody's just a liar in deceit. You can't be an honest person to work there, this kind of thing. And that's one of the things I try and counter. But I've not really had any kind of feedback like that. I'd be interested to hear what people think in that respect. Yeah.
So when you're writing historical fiction, you obviously have like a basis in reality, and you're writing about real world events. How much latitude do you give yourself to diverge from things that actually happened to support like your plot and your pacing and those other like writerly things you need to do?
I think as long as I'm not dealing with or not involving a real character, a real life person, because I want to be fair, you know. So I'll have some of the ambassadors they work with, or Shirley Temple Black in this respect. So I'll try and be fair, as fair as I can tell from what I've read about them. That was also came up in the Budapest Escape big time in terms of, you know, and in this case, you know, the buyer has to have some exchanges with the ambassador about what he's hearing and seeing in the street, and the ambassador is what his people are telling him. And I tried to hold the line firm on that without sort of pointing any fingers. So I really don't know what they were reporting back to Washington from Prague. So I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. When it's not a real person, if it's one of my fictional characters, then I feel I have a lot of leeway because that's my world and those are my people, and I want to develop them as in a way that's important for the storytelling. So, yeah.
So when you're writing about situations that you were involved with, how much does that bring back like memory or good memories, bad memories, like work stress, you know, like, cause you're not using escapism when you're writing about a world where you live.
Yeah. I think, I've been able to avoid that pretty much because, I was way too young during the Cold War. I'm an old fart, but I'm not that old fart. So I think, in that respect, that hasn't been an issue. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed working on the Prague Spring, because this was really starting to bring it home. I mean, I remembered this when I was a kid, you know, reading the Chicago Daily News and seeing what was going on in the world and out there. And I think as I continue this series, the closer I get to the contemporary period, then it's going to be more of an indicator. There was some stuff like in the Berlin Walls, when the wall goes up, you know, he's got to go in and help get a Soviet defector out, KGB defector out, as the wall's going up, which raises new challenges. I think in some respects, since I experienced and saw the wall a lot, both as a student, as a tourist, and as a professional, and then when the wall came down, so that had a lot of personal memories and tugs for me. And I think, and there it was kind of hard not to take pot shots at like the Felix Dzerzhinsky Brigade that guarded the wall, you know, those guys. And then you see the death strips and whatnot, and the mementos to people who didn't make it. I mean, there was one guy who was shot down in June of 1989. And you think, God, if only you had waited 4 or 5 months, you know, you could have walked across, you'd still be alive. So that's, I give myself leeway to take some pot shots in that respect on those incidents and cases. But for the most part, it's still kind of distant to me.
So, I mean, people that were in that era are still alive. When you're writing about like real life things that affected real people, do you feel like an added responsibility in the writing to be careful what you do and say?
Yeah, particularly if it's a real person in there, I think, well, what if the family reads this? And are they going to come to me and complain that you're unfair to their father or their parents or to their colleagues, you know? And that's in the back of my mind. So that's why I say I try to give people the benefit of the doubt and not draw much black and white easy distinction between, you know, this guy's an idiot, you know, and Carl Byer is brilliant and is always right, that kind of thing. So I do want to avoid that.
I mean, it's almost an external motivation for you, right, to make rounded characters and make sure you don't have these black and white characters.
Yeah, it is. Although at times you kind of fall into that trap too, because there's, you know, I mean, the KGB and the GRU, they're the bad guys. So, you know, but I often find that when you delve into what a person's background is as you create that character, that you realize, and this helps, I think, make a better story, that they have motives and reasons for what they do. You know, one of the things about the series, The Americans, which I resisted watching for a long time. I knew I was not going to like it. There are a bunch of KGB jerks, you know, illegals and whatnot. But then when I finally started watching, I thought, one of the strengths of that program was the background they gave to the Russian illegals that were living here. And because they would go back to their youth in the war, the deprivations that the Soviet Union suffered during the war, the deprivations they continued to live with in the economy and the society that clearly didn't function very well, and how it motivated so much of what they did. And I thought that they captured that really well. And that's something I try and do in these stories as well. You know, in the earlier books, Beyer develops a working relationship, cooperative at times, uncooperative, with the KGB officer, Sergei Chernov. He also, in Berlin Walls and in the Prague Spring, develops a working relationship with a Stasi officer. And I mean, anybody who worked on German history or German issues knows the Stasi, they were bad guys. Very effective, very efficient, capable, but they were bad guys. So how do you deal with that in this character? Well, I started giving him a background that explained it, a lot of what he was doing when he was approaching to work with Beyer, you know. And I think, and it's sort of left hanging how that relationship's going to go. And some people are urging me to write the next book to straighten that relationship out.
So I feel like that process is sort of magical. Right, like, where is this? Do you have a system for when you're creating characters like this, or is it something that you just start with something and it grows in your mind? Like, how does that happen? Right, because I'm really interested because it's different for everybody.
I think everybody you ask, you're gonna get a different approach. I am a pantser, I don't like to work from an outline because I think that restricts the story development and the characters. And I'll start with people, and I have no idea how that's going to end up. I had no idea that Beyer was going to have this close working relationship with this Stasi officer as the Red Army's rolling in, and that they'd be helping each other out so much. I had no idea that Sergei Chernov was going to, I mean, in the Tears of Innocence, the first book in the series, when he meets Sergei Chernov, it turns out, I don't want to give a spoiler here, but it turns out that, you know, he sees this guy as the enemy, and Chernov sees him as the enemy. And that's the way the relationship's going. Well, as I wrote the story and the characters developed, suddenly that got a little more flexible, a little softer there. You didn't have the harsh contours anymore. And that was a relationship that developed on and off in the next few books. So, Chernov had a history, Beyer had a history, and it influenced how they approached these things. So I think... And again, there's some twists and turns on the Chernov character, but also on the Stasi character. So I think, I don't want to say too much, but I'm surprised. It just seems as they start to write, possibilities emerge, and you start to play with those possibilities, you know?
Have you ever had that, like, personally? Like, I've been in situations where, you know, it's like survivors of a earthquake or a train wreck or something, right? Sometimes people on opposite ends of something who are adversaries have an experience that no one else on earth has. And when they get thrust together, like in real life, right? Like suddenly you do have this common bond over something, even though you're coming at it, no matter how horrible one side may be. Did you ever experience that? And like, it sounds like that's sort of what you're writing into these characters.
Yeah. I think so. Very much so. And I think I could give examples, but they're sort of like twists at the end of the books. And so I don't want to give anything away. But it's kind of like I sit back and I thought, whoa, I never saw that coming. I didn't think that was going to happen, you know. And it's a really pleasant feeling. I really enjoy that. So I enjoy having that same experience. Yeah.
Well, how much do you enjoy the writing itself, right? So you're pantsing, meaning, you know, you don't have the outline. You're just seeing where the story goes. You're sitting down writing. Yeah. A lot of writers just suffer through this process, and they like it at the end. Some of them like when they're in the revision process. Yeah. Like, how much do you like the actual creation?
You know, I have to say it varies. When I do the Private Eye mystery series that I had, and I'm working on a new manuscript in that series now, I enjoyed that probably because you put so much of yourself through it. It's first person narrative, and he's a smart ass and a hard ass guy and whatnot. And I think some people would say that's a reflection of some elements of my personality. Maybe I don't know, but it's just easier and more fun to write it that way. Third person narrative, like the spy novels, you're just much more, the prose, coming up with the right prose is much more demanding, I think, you know. There's only one writer that I've read recently, I think, that can combine those two, Don Winslow, in some of his fiction. And I just finished one book that I recommend because it's third person narrative, but almost reads like first person narrative. And it's California Fire and Life. And he, I'm reading this thing and I'm thinking, okay, this is what I should be doing in my book. Although it's first person narrative. Third person narrative, I don't want to do that because that would be consistent with Carl Beyer and his job and the time, you know. And it's, and to get to your question, it's tough, I think, writing that stuff. And, you know, and particularly when you don't have an outline, you don't know where you're going to go. And I'll sit down and I'm thinking, you know, I'll try and find excuses why I shouldn't write. I remember Jeffrey Deaver spoke at a C3 conference and he sort of, a day in the life of the writer. And most of his time is spent finding excuses not to write. You know, he's got, oh, the lawn, it's grown a lot since yesterday, so I better mow it again, you know. I've only got 3 bags of dog food left, so I better go get some more, you know. But the beauty is when you do kind of kick yourself in the butt and you sit down and you start working, things start to flow. Things start to come together. And that's a good feeling. And when at the end of the day, when I think I've created a good scene or a good chapter and moved the story along and the characters along, that's a really good feeling.
So I've tried that discovery writing one time, and what I found was a lot of pressure, right? Because I'm not knowing if it's going to work out. Am I wasting time, right? Where's this going? Like the everyday, I'm not sure where I'm headed. Do you get that? And if you get that, does that infringe on your creativity?
I've often sat down not knowing where the hell things are going to go, but I've always been pretty happy with whatever I was able to put down, realizing that it's not necessarily perfect. You know, it's as long as I move the story along, I figure I can always go back and check it on the revisions and correct things and straighten things out. And I think, as Tom Straw once said to me, the writer, he said, he tells students, right, new writers, never apologize for what you've written, and never think you're glued to that particular phrase and phrase. Be open to change it. And I said, yeah, I agree, because in fact, I'm thinking of the manuscript I'm working on now, and there's a couple things I want to fix. But I don't regret writing them because they helped me move the story along. But now I can improve on them. So I think, I may have experienced what you talked about when I first sat down. But I found that once I start writing, the crap just starts flowing out.
Have you ever had the experience where you're writing and then you realize you're hitting dead ends or it's not going anywhere and you have to abandon a project?
No, I haven't. Although I do have one manuscript in a drawer. But I thought I was sort of at a crossroads in my writing, and I decided to hang up the PI stuff for a while and delve into espionage fiction. But I've never encountered that, no.
Would you write if only your family and friends were reading what you were writing? Like, do you enjoy it to that level? Like, people, I'm always curious because, like, in writing, it's not like painting or something. If somebody you know paints, you know, you're not like, why aren't you hanging in the Louvre, right? Like, but for writers, it's always like, if you're not a bestseller, so do you enjoy it enough that you would write it if, like, only, like, your immediate family and friends read it?
You know, I don't think I would, but, well, maybe I would because there's not many people beyond my family and friends who read my stuff. It's not like I got any bestsellers out there, still enjoy writing them. So, you know, that must be the proof that in the pudding we're looking for.
I know many people who've told me they've read your stuff, so that's certainly not true. So when you're developing a character and you're doing it over a series like this, how much are you able to have the character grow? Like, how do you deal with an arc over in a series that you don't have a fixed number of books that you know you're writing?
It's a good question. You know, I just let the story take control of that. I'm willing to go wherever the story takes me. And I think, I was always, when I write the PI novels, I always go back to Raymond Chandler and his The Simple Art of Murder as to how you should write detective fiction. And one thing he would never have, his detectives never did, was get emotionally involved or romantically involved with a client or somebody on a case, because he felt it would compromise his integrity. And I thought, that's what my guy's going to be like. You know, that's what my guy's going to do. He's going to, you know, Raymond Chandler is going to be proud of my guy. Well, in the third book in the PI series, the protagonist, it's the same detective throughout, he gets romantically involved with a woman on this case, you know, and ends up with her at the end of the book. And I'm thinking to myself, how the hell did that happen? You know, I swore, I promised Raymond Chandler, the spirit of Raymond Chandler, this would never happen, but it did. It just seemed natural. I wasn't going to call a halt to it.
So where does that come from? Like, where do these story resolutions and character arcs, you know, how are they formed in your head, or where do they come from? And I've asked a lot of writers, like, basically, like, where story comes from. And I've heard some really interesting answers.
I have to tell you, aside from the general outline, I have no idea. You know, I mean, I knew I was going to write The Prague Spring, and I knew how that developed. And I did some additional reading, and it was, I was fortunate there. I was able to refine the story arc because an old friend who was a professor at Notre Dame recommended some memoirs from that period by Czech and Slovak politicians that were involved in this. So I was able to delve into to use those create sort of a more appropriate story arc. And then I just let the story unfold within that context, within that outline, you know, because I got to be honest with you, I have no idea where this stuff comes from. I mean, you know, I like to say I know the muse is sitting on my shoulder, which I, you know, that sounds like bullshit, and it probably is, but I honestly don't know.
So I'm curious, like, with the creativity, right? This is an art.
Yeah.
Do you do anything, like, some people have rituals, or do you do anything to sort of stoke your creativity or get into the mood when you're getting ready to write?
Yeah, I try and focus on a particular time of the day, late morning. That seems when I'm at my best, because in the afternoons at my age, I'm starting to fall asleep all the time. But I find that time is when I'm most productive. And then I also, you know, I'll read other contemporary fiction in that genre at the time, you know. But you got to be careful, because I remember I started out, the first draft of my first mystery was like, read like a Raymond Chandler wannabe, you know, and you got to develop your own voice. That's critical. And I think, I'll continue to read that, you know, stuff in that genre. I'll lay the history books aside for a while. And then I'll, you know, I don't know, I might put on some Bruce Springsteen or something and soft in the background and to sort of create the proper mood, or, you know, some other music that I like, which I think just kind of helps settle me down and just sort of getting a creative spirit going kind of thing.
Is writer's block a real thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a number of times I've sat down to write, or especially when I'm not at the machine, but I'm sitting in the room of the house and thinking, where the hell am I going? Where am I going to take this story? What do I do next? You know, maybe this is not the right thing. Maybe I should be thinking of something else. I mean, that is, I think, very real. But I find the way to get over it is just to start pounding on the keyboard, you know, and things will start to happen, particularly if your characters are real and you can let the characters take over the story. I think that really helps.
So, you know, I interview hundreds of authors, and I have people come into the salon every week, and there are people who want to write and aspiring. And one of the biggest differentiations between these people is some of them, the ones who want to write actually do, and the other ones talk about it a lot. So how is it, because you're prolific, how is it that you created this writing practice so that you can stick to it and write all these books?
Well, a big part of it is just stubbornness, pig-headedness. I mean, you know, like, I'm like most writers, the vast majority of writers, I had a pile of rejection notices, you know, and you're thinking to yourself, why am I doing this? Why don't I just relax and watch a movie or something? So there's a certain stubbornness and pig-headedness.
It's developing writing practice.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
How do you do that, to sit down every day? Do you write every day?
No, I don't. I try and write every day when I'm actively involved with the manuscript. But I think most of the time, not most of the time, but occasionally I'll say, I don't have anything to say today. So I don't do that. Now, I think at the same time, any kind of writing you're doing, if you're writing an email to somebody or someone, you know, that's, you're writing, you're practicing your craft, because you're putting words together to form a sentence, to create a story, to create a picture for someone. So I think, but in terms of working on the book, when I'm actively involved in a manuscript, I'll try and write every day, you know, for an hour or two, do one scene or chapter, and then it's done, and then I'll let it sit for a while. I know that's the recommendation, is let your book sit for a while. And so then I'll come back to it. And this is where I think you realize you must be a writer, because after a while, after a week or so, I get antsy, and I want to sit down again. I've left the manuscript I'm working on right now, I sit for about 2 weeks, because I was, you know, I had this thing planned. I did not want to sit and start doing a set of revisions that I would then put aside. Because once you get into the manuscript, you're on a roll, you know, and you're building off what you've done the day before. So I put it aside, and when I get back to Naperville, Illinois, on Saturday, on Sunday morning, I'm going to sit down and start the next set of revisions in the book, because I've waited long enough as it is.
So you're taking a break between revision iterations, basically. Yeah. Why is that? Why is it when you come back to it, you read it more like a reader?
I think because, you know, you're really wedded to the words you have on paper. And you, as you write them, you tend to think that, you know, well, I'm a writer. I know what I'm doing. So it's good. I think that when you put a pause in there, you can stand back and you realize, you know, that doesn't work, or I got this gap there. I got to go back to that. And so I'll write a note on a piece of paper, you know, next to it, say to remind me that I need to check on the town of Berwyn, which is right next to Cicero. It's one of the southern suburbs. And I said, you know, at some point I say, gee, this is supposed to be the town where you could smell the stench from the slaughterhouses. So I'm trying to work Chicago into this thing, you know? And so you're grabbing elements of the Chicago story. But I don't know if Berwyn was, I mean, it's right next to Cicero, so you could play on that. And there's elements of Cicero in the story already. But I don't know if they were smelling the stench from the slaughterhouses, which actually were tourist attractions at the time, which is remarkable when you think about it.
A slaughterhouse was a tourist
attraction? Yeah, people would go through there. They would have walkways, you know, as these animals are getting slaughtered and stuff. It's kind of horrific.
It's like Disneyland for serial killers.
Yeah. But these were like highbrow people, you know, upper middle class, yeah.
So you make you're doing historical fiction. That's an important point when you have a lot of research. So you're making notes as you go when you find holes. So you're not stopping to research while you're doing first draft.
Oh, and I'll do that. I mean, yeah. What I'll do is I'll first draft. I just want to get the manuscript down on paper, and I will make notes. And then during the pause, I might do some research. Like one of the first things when I get back, I got to look up the history of Berwyn, because I think it's actually was a pretty prosperous middle class town. So I don't want the people of Berwyn to burning me in effigy. So then
although that would be a great marketing technique.
Well, I'm telling you, yeah. Maybe I'll instigate it. I'll get some of my former colleagues here to instigate something like that, you know. But I think I'll do the research between the drafts, because I don't want to pause and wait, you know. Like I'm on a roll, you know, he's and also I should let people know that my wife is one of my beta reader, and she'll go through it, and now she'll check the historical accounts and stuff. She's always fact checking on me, and I remember she caught me on, scolded me about it, because it was in one of the earlier books. I have a buyer going out to Heathrow Airport in the 50s, and she looks up, she says, there was no Heathrow Airport in the 50s. It was London Airport near the village of Heathrow, and then it's expanded, so I had to go back and check. Fix that.
How much of the research are you doing before you start to write?
Oh, it depends on how familiar or comfortable I am with the history. But I did a lot of reading on the Czech Prague Spring, but also because I work in the Czech coup of 48. And so I did a lot of reading on that. And that's one of the things as I told my wife, she made a plan about all the history books I have piled all over the house. But they do come in to use at some point, eventually, hopefully. And so I was able to do a lot of that reading. And then there's, as I mentioned, the recommendation for the memoirs of certain people who were involved in the Prague Spring. And the same thing, you know, on the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Turkish Triangle. I didn't have to do a lot of research since I worked on Turkey so much at the agency. That, I mean, some of that stuff was just so fresh in my mind, and I probably put too much into that book. But the same thing, you know, like Tears of Innocence, the post-war Berlin. I was reading, just read a lot about the situation in Germany in 45 in Berlin to provide a lot of the background.
You say you put too much into the book. When people are reading historical fiction, they're looking for facts, they're looking for history.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
How do you draw that line between what's affecting your plot and what people are picking up the book for in the first place?
I think it's just, you got to develop a feel for it. But that is a critical point, is how much are you putting in? Are you putting in too much that you're slowing the pace, that you're slowing the progress of the story? And I think, but you want to have that in there. And so you find ways to work it in various conversations or various events. I mean, I put stuff from the Byzantine Empire period into the Turkish Triangle because, you know, Anatolia was the heart of the empire in many ways. So I think, but it's almost episodic. It's quick. You're in and you're out, you know. You just provide something to get people a little bit of interest. But mostly you're really working on, trying to entertain.
The Shirley Temple thing was cool. What was the most surprising thing you found with this book when you were doing research?
Well, the Shirley Temple one was a big part of it. I think the other part was the memoirs I read. They were able to draw the lines of combat and distinction, what groups were supportive of the which ones were aligned with Moscow and which one. And you really, at the time, of course, we thought, well, the Prague Spring, it was wildly popular. I mean, that's what the Czechs and Slovaks wanted. And so you thought it was almost universal, but not so. There was a lot of resistance, even in the Czech government.
What was that resistance from? Like, what was motivating it?
I think motivated because, one, they felt it was a betrayal of the revolution, you know. Two, they felt that their positions were in jeopardy, since these were the hardcore Stalinists. And three, they felt that, you know, they weren't getting away with it anyway because Moscow wouldn't allow it. So I think, were the major elements. And but there were others that were just, and it, you see this when you go to these some of these museums in Prague now, and it's that it was, it seemed almost inevitable, but of course it was crushed. And it was 20 years later, almost that, almost to the day that you had the Velvet Revolution in Prague and the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe.
Tell us a little bit about your publishing journey here. This is with Coffee House Press, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you have multiple books with them, right? So what was like, I know a lot of people, their first thought now is self-publishing. A lot of people go traditional. There's a hybrid option. What was your decision-making when you're getting your books out into the world?
Well, I wanted to do the traditional publishing route because I'm too lazy to do a lot of that stuff myself. And I don't think I'd be very good at it, you know, to do the editing. Oh, I mean, you do editing and revisions, but then, you know, you would hire... Yeah, my publisher provides editing services, and particularly strategically. But I thought, I just want to write these books and get them out there, see what happens. Of course, you realize once you do that, your job is only half over because you've got to do all the promotional work yourself. But I think, my particular experience was, like a lot of people, the toughest job was getting an agent. And I got an agent. Working out of San Diego.
Who's your agent?
That, at the time, it was the Harris Literary Agent. And I think today it functions as the Lee Harris Literary Agency out of San Diego. And this was early on. They were just starting out. And they took me and I thought, oh, great. You know, you see that as a sort of an affirmation of your future as a writer. You know, oh, great, I got an agent. And somebody who thinks I actually know what I'm doing. And so after a year, they couldn't sell my books. It was a private eye novels. So they just cut me loose. And I thought, okay, it's a business. I understand, you know. So then I got another agent who, the woman who ran it, boy, she was a very convincing talker. And I thought, man, I got movie contracts coming in here in no time, you know. Well, that didn't happen either. And I realized that their business model was to make money off the authors and not the books.
How did they do that, by the way? It's like a cautionary tale.
Yeah, it was kind of like, it wasn't self-publishing, but it was like subsidized publishing. They would say, well, you know, we've got 300 books we want to get out there, but because you're new, we need you to help pay for getting these things printed, you know. And they would do all the editing. They would get the cover design, and they would get the things listed on Amazon and whatnot. So they did perform a role, but that was it. And they didn't always – and I was supposed to get 300 copies of the books, which were fine. You know, I'll sell them myself. I wasn't always getting 300 copies of the books. So finally I said – this is bullshit. This is not going anywhere. So I went to, there used to be a Chicago murder mystery conference called Murder Loves Company. And I met a senior editor there for Five Star Publishing out of Maine. A lot of people went with Five Star. You know, there are a lot of people when you talk to that are now very successful. They started at some point with Five Star. And it was great. She said, you know, if I don't like your book, you know, send me what you got. If you don't like it, I'll let you know why. But then they sent me back and they said, well, we publish this for you and here's an advance and whatnot. But then, so I thought, okay, I've got a publisher I can trust. And they only printed hard copies and they sold mostly to libraries. But that's fine. That's like, you know, a couple thousand books right there. So I said, okay, fine. And then I wrote, that was Tears of Innocence. And then I wrote the Habsburg Variation. And I thought that was going to be it because I just wanted to capture a story that reflected on the world that disappeared with the collapse of the Eastern European empires in 1919. It's always found that a sort of a fascinating intersection in history. And I had the manuscript all ready to go, and we were living in London, and my wife says, you better go to Vienna, because it's been a while since you've been there, and you got to check on, you know, your scenes and the accuracy. It was a good thing I did. But as I'm reading my emails, I'm walking down the ramp at Heathrow, no longer London Airport, Heathrow Airport. I'm walking down there and I'm looking at my emails, and there's one from the publisher, Five Star, saying, we want to let you know, it was a mass mailing, And we're not doing thrillers or mysteries anymore. We're only going to do frontier and Western fiction. Well, they included an attachment of publishers that they thought would be willing to pick up new authors. And I looked at the website for Coffee Town. It's also Camel, Coffee Town and Camel Press. And I sent them a query, first 50 pages. And they responded favorably. And they said, you know, it's still available. We'd like to look at the manuscript. And then they said, okay, we'd like to offer you a contract. But you're thinking of a series. And I said, I hadn't thought about one. But, Cold War, if we make it a Cold War series, there's a lot going on. They said, yeah, because we want to offer you a contract for more than one book. And I said, okay, you got a series. Let's go, And that's my relationship with Coffee Town and Camel. And it's been very, I think, beneficial in that respect. That the senior editor is very good at keeping me honest on things. And they were recently bought out by Epicenter. Not recently, a couple years ago, by Epicenter. I'm not sure what that relationship is and who does what. But I work with the senior editor at Coffee Town Press. And they've said that they like my writing, so they'll publish anything I send them. And I said, okay, that sounds good to me, So that's my journey. I think the problem, but the industry is changing so much, and it's, so if anybody wants to self-publish, it doesn't have the same stigma it used to have. And I remember when I was making that transition from Five Star to Coffee Town, there were a number of authors said, think about hybrid, they'll keep a traditional publishing outlet, but they'll also do some self-publishing. And I was at a book event in Wisconsin, and a woman next to me had a couple series going, kind of cozy mysteries, and there was one involving a sheriff in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and she bought the copyright back and sold it herself as an ebook. And she says within a year, she made enough money to pay off the cost of getting the copyright back, which was like $20,000 for her. So I think...
The hybrid charged her $20,000 for to get her the rights back.
Yeah, get the rights back.
Oh
yeah.
My God,
that's steep. I know when Coffee Town said they wanted to put all of the Cold War series out under their label, we approached Five Star to get the copyright back for Tears of Innocence, and they just gave it to us. Which was, I thought, was quite nice. And certainly happy to see that.
Well, it seems appropriate that we're interviewing an author from the Camel Press here. So, okay, I'm going to come around with the microphone. If anybody has questions, let me know. If I'd ask you just for the podcast, if you would just repeat the question or summarize it.
Sure.
Okay. Do we have any questions over here? Here we go.
Bill, thanks for pronouncing your hero's last name. I've never known. I was going with Bear. If you get back to that series, what's next?
That's a good question, because the question is, if I return to the Cold War thriller series, what's next? And I don't want to make a trip back in time. I would have to go forward. But there's no really defining dramatic event like the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Cold War moved into a much more, I think, transitional and important phase as it began to open up with the after the CSCE Treaty, which allowed East Europeans access to, Western media and a greater knowledge of what life was like in the West. And I think that was the critical element in the collapse of communism, because the population there just said, enough, enough's enough. But there's not that single dramatic, crisis. So I would have to find some other setting for it. There was the Greek and Turkish invasion of Cyprus in 74, which might be possible. That's something I'm very familiar with. That's a possibility, but it would really, the story should revolve around the relationship between Karl Bayer and the Stasi officer, Alexander von Hohen. So I think I got to find something else to work with. Maybe I'll just create one by myself.
Thanks so much for being here, Bill. I'm not familiar with Karl Bayer. What can you tell us? You mentioned a little bit about him being smart ass,
yeah,
hard ass. What else would this character be distinct from other characters that we may read or have seen on television shows that are about spies?
Okay. The question is what would make Karl Bayer distinctive from other spy characters and heroes that you would see in television or read about books? I think with Bayer, his background, his family were German social democrats that fled the Nazis and came to the U.S. So he has that German background, which reflects my own family's background to a certain degree. And I think and this sort of motivates him, but he always feels, he really bristles if somebody refers to him as a German. He says, no, I'm an American, German heritage, but I'm an American, damn it. You know, and that comes up a couple times in various books. And I think there's that element. So there's a personal interest that he has in the defeat of the Nazis and the rebuilding of Europe, but also in contributing to the emergence of the U.S. as the global power that sort of is, and the guarantor of the post-war social and economic order. So he's, that is a real motivation for him. It's not just a personal family thing. So I think that explains a lot of what he's doing and how he approaches these issues.
Hi, what is the most admirable and most despicable quality of a chief of station?
I've been asked, even though I was an analyst, the most admirable and despicable quality of the chief of station. I would say if the chief of the most despicable quality would be a chief of station does not trust his analysts, if there's analysts working for him, and doesn't trust the analysts to know everything. And the most honorable care, I think the most honorable thing is, as I see it, it's a management position, and you have to handle people and know how to handle people. And I think it seems to me a really top-notch chief of station knows how to handle and promote and develop the officers that work under him. We're going to do most of the work. Because this, but people don't realize, you know, when I see the homeland, and they have the one character who's the European division chief, and he spends all his time in Europe working on this one case. I thought, who's running the Europe division back there, you know? So it's I would say it's the most honorable or the best characteristic would be, in my mind, the station chief who can blend that strategic vision, which you have to meet the requirements you get from headquarters, and developing the people that work for you to do that. And the most despicable, I don't know, one who just sees it as a chance to promote his own career. If you do well, your career is going to do well, I guess. That's an analyst viewpoint.
Bill, I'm wondering about a rule of thumb for your character development. For example, in your Saigon book, you had a couple of characters you built nicely, the old OSS guy and the French guy.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the true characters that were out there as well as Carl. But for your new book, do you try to develop two characters, three characters? And how do you, for example, the French guy was kind of a rich character. How do you draw that to make him somebody that you can identify with?
Well, excuse me, the French character, for those of you, for those few of you who have yet to read us on that second, is the interesting thing about him in my mind was I knew I wanted to get somebody from the French colonial regime in there to that Barr would have to deal with. So he's an officer who was in Dien Bien Phu. He escaped. He's one of the few who's able to escape with a Laotian group that was there fighting with the French. And then he goes to Saigon while the French are still running things and opens a brothel. And but he has a wife, this Laotian villager who nursed it back to health. And I think, but I just thought, I've got to get a French guy in this story here, just like I've got to get an OSS officer here. And so I wanted to have the OSS officer, that sort of, that character sort of evolved as I was writing it, where he, you know, he really could find his place back home in the U.S. He stays in Saigon. He's got a lot of bitterness. He thinks he's, people like him know better, but their counsel isn't being listened to. The French guy, I mean, he sort of was in many ways a fish out of water, and that also developed as he's running his brothel, but he's he realizes that his days are probably numbered. You know, how long is he going to be able to do this? You know, and particularly as the Saigon government is proving itself to be so incompetent. So I'm not sure that answers your question, Steve. But in the Prague Spring, the characters I introduced that I try and develop are actually two case officers who are working together on the Soviet target. And I think who else? Well, the Stasi officer who really evolves as a character much more, I think, and his relationship with Bayer, Bayer's willingness to work with this guy because he needs him. And I think, so there were those guys, the new characters that developed there.
So going back to this rule of thumb, you need two or three or four major characters besides Carl?
No, I don't think there's any set rule on numbers. Just see how the story evolves. and the roles they, the functions they fulfill. So in this case, you know, the two case officers, just it seemed like it wouldn't work because one of them is a first-time officer, first tour. The other is like on his third tour. And so Byer says, well, I'm going to want you to work with the third guy on his third tour to help you develop as an officer because you're out there on your own, you know, and in this really demanding and tricky environment. So I think, so there's no set rule on numbers or whatnot. It just seems what the characters need to be doing.
Bill, how did your writing as a CIA analyst influence your writing as a novelist?
I think what it did was it influenced my writing as a novelist in terms of the message that is the backdrop that's being carried forward. You know, he starts in 47. The U.S. is new in its role on the world stage. As a, you know, it's a leadership role. We had resisted for decades. It's also a new role for the agency. I mean, we were brand new on this. And in many ways, we were trying to run an intelligence program that resembled what we did in World War II during the war. And it's that didn't work. I mean, there were other things we did right. But I think it was the knowledge I developed of the agency as a whole and its mission. And the other thing is I try and get analysts involved in some of these stories, not just case officers, you know. So I think to show that they had a role as well in this stuff. And I think and that comes through. So in some ways, it influenced my perception of the agency's mission and capabilities. But it's, you know, as I told people, the readers are going to be more interested in what case officers are doing, what the quote-unquote spies are doing, not so much the analysts. I mean, the analysts may be up briefing the president, but that doesn't make for that exciting and entertaining a story, you know? I mean, it's very impactful, very, very important. But let's face it, you're here to entertain. So you're going to work, so they're going to work with analysts more, or case officers more often in these kinds of stories. And so, but you bring in, you know, as an analyst, I felt obligated to refer periodically to the role of analysts in the business.
Hi. I just have a question. As an author in the year 2026, what is, like, the dynamic with AI? Do you use AI? Do you completely ignore or ostracize AI? Is it an editor? Is it a co-author? Like, how do you move forward with that kind of dynamic?
I do not use AI. The question is on the role of AI in what I do. I do not use AI at all. I refuse to use AI at all. I consider it the spawn of Satan for writers. I think because
my grandmother called the color television the spawn of Satan.
So anyway, I think I just don't see why an author would want to abdicate any of his responsibility for writing the stories, developing the characters to AI, you know, it's just befuddles me. And I think it's a real danger right now to the writing profession. But I, like I say, I'm an old fart, so I can ignore it for a little while yet. So, yeah.
I'm a, you know, first time author, and Jeffrey's been trying to help me, you know, write something that you could actually send to somebody. And my question is, my World War II stories really start later, like in the 1980s to the present, because there's a huge halo effect from everything that happened during the war, right? Mm-hmm. And then the post-war era. So right now I have this weird situation where the CIA is on it and then MI6 is on it, but since it takes place in Switzerland, the Swiss police are somehow involved. Can the CIA and MI6 actually work well together? Or is that like a recipe for disaster? Because right now we're just about to have a big moment in the book.
The question is on the relationship between the CIA and the MI6 and how well do they work well together? How well can they work together? And what's to be made of that? You know, we do have a very long-standing and special relationship with the MI6 and MI5. And it's lasted for decades. In many ways, they helped the birthing of the agency, but also they did it for their own reasons. I mean, they were the ones behind the coup in Iran in 1953. So I think we kind of went along with it. And,
oh, wait, the British were?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was the British were the ones.
They put it on us.
Oh, yeah, of course. I think But I think it's a important relationship, and they've helped us out on a number of times. For instance, Penkovsky, who was considered one of the greatest assets in the Cold War, I believe, if I remember the story correctly, we first turned it down because Angleton thought no Soviet could be a truce. Could never betray it. Yeah. System. And any Soviet that approached us had to be a dangle and a provocation. But the British said, no, we think this guy's good. And of course, he turned out to be one of the most significant espionage assets of the Cold War. So I think there's that. But there's no question that now the MI6 just does not have the resources to match up with us. And we often, my impression is we often carry them along. And it's...
Is it technology at this point?
I think it's money.
Yeah,
it's just money. Okay. I've been to meetings with the liaison services in London where we had to bring the coffee and cookies, you know, because they just didn't have the funds for it. So I think that's a problem. And I won't say any more about some of the relationships I witnessed, but I think, we have a very big and significant station in London that works directly with MI6 and MI5. And it's a very important relationship.
Right. Have you seen that show, The Agent?
No, I haven't. Sorry.
It takes place in London and it shows the building, which is like beautiful. I mean, I don't know if that's the real building.
The SIS building, the MI6 building?
Yeah.
Yeah, it probably is. I'm sorry. Yeah, the MIS, SIS, MI6.
The CIA's building.
In London?
Yes, they show it. I was wondering.
I got to see that.
It's a BBC production, so maybe it's make-believe. I don't know.
Yeah. No comment.
Okay. All right. So, Bill, congratulations on this book. Where should people go to get it?
You can get it on Amazon. You can get it through any bookstore that you want. You can get it here tonight, of course. And I think, any bookstore would order it. You can get it through them. Barnes & Noble, definitely. And I think Amazon, what else? Those would be the main ones.
And you have a website?
I do have a website. It's www.billwrapsbooks, all one word, billwrapsbooks.com. It's a website. I have to confess, I don't pay a lot of attention to it. And I realize now I've got to get in there. But my daughter is the one who has taken over running it. And she's been overseas for the last couple of years, and she's coming home this summer. So I plan to do a lot of updating and get it going. So
thank you all so much for coming. I'd like to ask, if you get a moment, just go on Amazon and rate his book. It makes a really big difference. If everyone here just rated it, it would really help with the sales. And if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's Literary Salon, please rate us. You can Google or Yelp or Open Table, wherever you rate restaurants. That would be super helpful. And if you go to Elaine's literarysalon.com, you can sign up for our newsletter. And we're offering all kinds of fun workshops and things as well. So check us out. Bill, thank you. This has been really wonderful. And you've got your signing up here.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Jeff. This has been a wonderful experience. And I can't help but endorse it wholeheartedly and do spread the word and find out when others or books are coming, because there's a lot of good writers in the area, a lot of good books coming out here, and you get to discuss them in a really congenial atmosphere, a personal atmosphere, which is, I think, first rate.
All right, so come up here and get your book signed. He's got them for sale and he'll be signing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.